I'm Jennifer Magnabosco. I've been with the mental health section now for about 5 years. On the governing council and about to move off of that and go on to the action board. So I'm very happy to be here in that capacity. I also am a researcher with the Veterans Administration. I'm a management consultant and researcher with the LA County Department of Mental Health, and also do some teaching at Cal State Los Angeles, University of Southern California, and also a University of Traditional Chinese Medicine. So I'm involved in a lot of different workforce issues and a number of different organizations. And the work that I'm going to talk to you about today is part of a long-standing body of work that I'm doing with the LA County Department of Mental Health. Marvin Southern, who's the director of the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health, is also my co-author on this particular piece and also really the spearheader for a lot of the work I'm going to talk about today. Okay, I have no relationships to disclose that we were required to disclose. So today I'm going to take you through some result highlights for one piece of this body of work that has to do with a key informant manager interview project having to do with staff well-being and retention. And what we're doing with this body of work is trying to create blueprints for change to try and really improve the culture at the Department of Mental Health with regards to staff well-being and retention. And I'd just like to briefly acknowledge that there were a variety of staff and also union staff affiliated with the county who participated in this work, and also two committees, the Department of Mental Health Staff Advisory and Staff Well-Being and Retention Committees, and I've been employed as a consultant for both of those committees for the past 7 years. Just a little background for the impetus for this body of work, really looking at staff well-being and retention in the county. When Marv Southern came on as director of the county, he was establishing a number of different committees to really get at issues in the workplace. One of them was the Staff Advisory Committee and also the Staff Well-Being and Retention Committee. And so shortly after that, in 2004, the Mental Health Services Act of California was passed, and some of you may know that that particular historical piece of legislation was using tax dollars to really infuse the mental health systems in the state of California to be able to provide services for disadvantaged women, children, all kinds of different populations that were not actually receiving services, and create a lot of services that were considered innovative and also evidence-based. So the county itself, you know, LA County and all the counties in California were going through the beginnings of transformation. And also the county itself, with regards to mental health, really was kind of not in great shape with regards to morale. So back in 2003, 4, and 5, the focus was a lot more on retention because retention wasn't going so well. And then retention did pick up, and what we decided to do is really focus our efforts more on overall issues of staff well-being. Hence, this particular project, which is taking a look at staff well-being. It's a qualitative project we did, interview project, to really get at the language that's used about staff well-being and retention, and to really get at the what's and the how's of what's related to staff well-being, so that we can better understand these concepts and then really be able to better make plans to address the issues associated with them. The other two phases that you see listed there for 2011 on are the other phases of this project I won't be talking about today, but hope that in the future as we move along in those regards, I'll be back sharing some of that information. Okay, so as I just briefly described, the overall goal for this particular project was to better understand and describe, you know, what are we really talking about when we're referring to staff well-being, and, you know, how is staff well-being really being implemented, you know, what kinds of activities, what kinds of, you know, working or best practices, what kinds of facilitators and barriers are associated with staff well-being, and where should we really go from there, you know, thinking about what's current day, to where we need to go in order to, you know, really think about how we can improve staff well-being within the county. So today I'm going to give you a little flavor of some of that data that shows some of the language and the frameworks that are associated with staff well-being and retention, and give you also some of the data on the manager's perspectives on staff well-being and retention. We need to start somewhere. We didn't want to do a big survey. I think the other surveys that were described today are really good examples of things that we might want to do after this overall qualitative exploratory phase is completed. So I'm happy to kind of follow you all, because it shows what can be after this body of work. So we chose managers to start out with because we really want to find out what was going on across the county with regards to all the top management. But our plan is to look at line staff and both clinical and non-clinical. So this was, as I mentioned, a key informant interview study, cross-sectional point in time. The semi-structured interview protocol we developed was based on the literature and all types of information sources associated with the county, input from a variety of staff, from the director. We ended up having 44 closed-ended and open-ended questions, and we had questions that fell into two categories. Things we were referring to as the macro type questions, things having to do with the county's organization and structure, and then things that fell into the micro category, things about staff individuals, that kind of went across the spectrum of who the staff were with regards to management, clinical, and non-clinical staff. We wanted to make sure that the interview study we did, though, was representative of the types of facilities that were operating within the county. The county has 8 regions, so we definitely wanted to have interviews that took place with managers in those 8 regions. We definitely wanted to take a look at different managers' perspectives who serve different populations, adults, children, and then also different ethnic and cultural backgrounds of clients. So we did a very purposeful yet targeted strategy with regards to selecting the different types of programs who were headed by certain managers, and then overall managers that were at more the deputy regional level. We conducted 19 interviews with 20 participants, and you see there, we had a variety of the management types, and I'm also happy to say that we were able to meet with 3 union managers, and I have to say those were some of our more interesting interviews. Yeah, I will say that they were extremely cooperative and actually really behind our efforts to really get at these issues more directly. So this slide here just shows who our respondents were. 80% were female, as you might expect in the county system with more women really working in the field of mental health. The ethnicity breakdown for the respondents actually modeled a lot of what was going on in the county. Majority white, but then definitely representation from African American, Hispanic, American Indian, and Korean ethnicities. MSW was the most prominent degree that most of the respondents had, and most of the respondents, had been in the county system or at DMH for a pretty long time, so we were working with pretty seasoned individuals, and they had direct and indirect reports that varied from either 7 to 186 staff, and they definitely had, of course, some experience with staff retention and staff well-being activities. But as we go on here in the slides, we'll take a look at how that really kind of breaks down in terms of categories of what seemed to be important and not important. Okay, so we were using, as I was saying, qualitative approaches to better understanding staff well-being and retention. So we were doing a lot of content analysis, really looking at the interview data and not really thinking ahead of time any kind of preconceived categories for analysis. We were letting the analysis really emerge from the data, and we had reams and reams of tables that actually came out of all of the data that we were calling blueprints for change, and also really a lot of tables that could be used in, say, the training department or in HR or other departments within the county that you could say, hey, look at the different types of categories of things we might want to work on here, starting points for change to improve the culture around staff well-being and retention. Okay, so the results we broke down into 2 different categories, again, the what's of staff well-being and retention, and then the how's. So I'm going to show you a little bit here from the what results. And just to say right off the bat that when we're thinking about the language and frameworks that people express or really are conceiving with regards to staff well-being and retention, staff well-being and retention is a real conceptually complex kind of a concept or a phenomenon. There's a lot of unclear distinctions between when someone is talking about staff well-being versus staff retention. There's a lot of interrelated language and concepts, and we thought that was a very important finding because when we're really trying to break down, these kinds of language and frameworks and then turn them into some, actions for change, we have to really know what we're really talking about and being clear. There's no standard way of talking about staff well-being and retention at the Department of Mental Health. And what also is very clear is that you really need to access multiple perspectives when you're talking about staff well-being and retention so that you really can understand and really work on establishing a holistic foundation of the language concepts and the components that are associated with staff well-being and retention. Okay, so at the top of some of these slides, you'll see some of the actual questions we used in the interview protocol. And so this one shows that, as a manager, what's your working definition of staff well-being and staff retention? And so we had a lot of definitions. I'll show you a couple examples in a minute or two. But what really struck us across all these different definitions was that there were certain conceptual components that were reflected in all the definitions. So these were kind of, again, some of our anchor points for what's really important when we're talking about staff well-being and retention. Things having to do with organizational culture, things having to do with management and teamwork, things about job role and function, things about job conditions, things about, values, as an individual or values as a, county public health county departmental health worker, and things about career pathing. So these were, certain kinds of components of staff well-being and retention that, we are using, in some of our other work to, work on blueprints for change. This is just an example here of some of the definitions with regards to, how when we ask them the question, how their answers would come out. And the underlined words here kind of show, the components I just showed you kind of highlight here, role, working environment, relationships, communication, values, management style. These are the kind of words that we were picking out of all the different definitions to say what is common amongst all of them. I'm going to skip here the staff retention. And then just to say that another question that we asked was, do you think that your clinical support staff would agree with your definitions? 70% of the managers thought that they would, but they thought that they needed to really kind of modify their language in order to be more consistent with what it was their staff would be thinking. I'm going to skip over a few slides here just to say that, as I had mentioned before that the Staff Well-Being and Retention Committee was one of the committees that was formed to, work on these issues, and we had our own definition that we developed, and it was just one of our other questions to say, how can we really get at some of the language here, and we need to modify some of that in order to match what people are really thinking. Okay, some of the interesting things that also kind of came across a number of the questions was that managers indicated that there are particular factors or issues about staff well-being and retention that pertain to this short list here of, if we're really thinking about pulling out those particular factors or issues with regards to staff well-being and retention, we have to think about these things across different types of clinics, across, thinking about adult versus child-only facilities, across regions, across different cultural populations. So this is just, an analytical point here to demonstrate the fact that staff well-being retention is complex, and we've kind of got to, drill down to these different types of, component areas to really figure out if we're looking at a facility, for example, that deals with adult clients, issues for staff there with regards to their staff well-being and retention on the job may be different than, for example, those staff who work in child-only facilities. Thinking about, how staff well-being and retention activities could actually be improved, everybody said, look, if we're going to have a change in the county, We need, you know, buy-in, top-down and bottom-up. We need measures and strategies to actually, you know, better get at this. We need a top-down start, meaning the director of mental health, Mara Southard, needs to really put this out there as an initiative. And they really thought this was going to take a long time to change, but everybody seemed to be committed to really wanting to improve and work on this. Let me skip here a few of these slides. I'm certainly happy to send these to everybody, but I know Kathleen's going to give me the 1 minute to sign in probably 30 seconds here. let me just say a few words here that there weren't any indicators or measures that managers could point to in plans or budgets to really, you know, codify staff well-being and retention. There's not really a lot of, you know, explicit information that they were using to actually deal with, you know, how they would roll out some of their staff well-being and retention activities. So there's a lot of work to be done. And this slide here illustrates what the top five action steps are for the Department of Mental Health to take to improve staff well-being and retention. Number one is, you know, increasing management interest and staff involvement in these particular issues. The second is improving mentoring and performance reviews. Third is, you know, providing better communications for promotion opportunities. The fourth is, you know, as I was, you know, just kind of alluding to a minute ago, providing tools and training to increase general support for not just work on the job, but also, you know, how to actually improve staff well-being and retention. And then the biggest thing, too, even though it's listed as number five, is to really open up communication. All right. So one of the things, though, that really came out across all the interviews is that there's an intense perspective on wanting to improve staff well-being and retention, but there's also a split perspective, meaning there's a lot of enthusiasm and hopefulness that staff well-being and retention can be improved, but there's a lot of fear that it will be slow or that it won't even occur. So they're really looking to leadership, more of a top-down approach to helping to deal with this. One of the committees, you know, I had mentioned that I'm employed by the Staff Well-Being and Retention Committee, is perceived as a legitimate source of hope and action to really open up those lines of communication and to work on, you know, certain projects and activities to improve. But one of the other things that came out in the interviews was that in order for staff well-being and retention to really improve, not only do we need the top-down, you know, charge from, let's say, Marv Southard, but there also needs to be some type of structure, some type of group, some type of entity that is charged with doing this, separate from HR and separate from other entities, but some separate kind of entity so that people feel safe and they feel like they also, you know, have a place to go where staff well-being and retention is looked at holistically. Okay, so that's just to say that you know, a variety of these things that we found in this, you know, initial look at staff well-being and retention are not really being addressed, and those tables that I mentioned before that are really kind of considered blueprints for change aren't really being implemented and then also coordinated with some of the other efforts within the county system. Everybody who was interviewed said that they feel that the morale will continue to decline, that staff well-being and retention and also, you know, specifically stress is not going to decrease. And that communication and trust within the department will not improve. And really, the bottom line to all of this is that if staff well-being and retention really isn't addressed well and isn't really prioritized, then, you know, wanting to provide world-class healthcare, world-class mental health care, which is the mission of DMH, is really not going to happen. Because if you don't have staff who are happy, feeling, you know, trusting amongst their, you know, peers, and, you know, of management, then really what's really at risk here is the quality of care that clients receive.
Okay. I have a question pertaining to the research that was done in Massachusetts. Very powerful numbers that presented up there. That really presents some concern, especially within the minority community where individuals that do not speak English aren't represented in the, so far as the mental health profession is concerned. Is the state doing anything to recruit bilingual psychologists?
I am not aware of any state initiatives on that. One thing that is happening is that we've had to, under court order, implement children's system of care in the Medicaid system, and that is using a number of parent partners that are peers and are much more representative of the communities being served. In the long term, there may, you know, if we can create reasonable ladders for people that are interested in progressing, that might be one thing. But I'm not aware of any.
You said National Health Service Corps?
Yeah, it can be difficult. It's relatively not used as much for mental health professionals. It's more used for primary care and doctors. And we do have a part of the Department of Public Health that was very enthusiastic about us doing this work because they really want to build upon it and use it, and they're the ones that designate the health service shortage areas that are the places where that loan stuff can happen.
Do you suspect that these numbers would be similar to other states as well?
I can't imagine why they'd be different. If you know, we tend to have a greater supply, but I don't think there's any reason to think that other states are much more diverse in who gets that level of education and education.
What could be done on a federal level so that recruitment efforts could be put forth so that these individuals could be represented more appropriately in the mental health area?
Well, I mean, getting some of the existing mechanisms for loan forgiveness and professional shortage areas applied to mental health practitioners could probably help. But you also probably have to address it at the application level. And I'm not as aware of that because we were looking at Massachusetts and at the federal, what could we use that existed at the federal level.
The Affordable Care Act has provision for enhanced funding and emphasis on training and training in kind of collaborative roles that make make a better use of a different mix of professionals that should have implications for workforce shortages.
I mean, it's kind of astounding that in many states they enforce affordable housing, but they can't implement something where they force the states to have mental health care for individuals that don't speak English, for example, where it creates a problem on a long-term basis when they become adults. They carry the mental illness for years on end.
Mm-hmm. I think from some of our work, there's some really important cultural considerations that you're bringing up, that you know, different populations have different understanding of mental health, different willingness to accept it, different stigma attitudes, and that in all of our training programs, particularly mental health training programs, there needs to be a much better emphasis on these cultural variations in beliefs.
Oh, but that's setting that aside, because that's a totally different, you're opening up another door or another can of worms, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Setting that aside, simply being able to communicate in the same language and express what you're feeling so far as a mental health condition is concerned, is, I would think, a basic need of these individuals. It's not even being addressed.
Yeah, and I can't tell you. I know that there are interpretation requirements. Hospitals have to provide interpretation. Many mental health providers do provide interpretation, but I don't think it's an absolute requirement. I mean, that's the shorthand way to do it, where you have the mismatch of who's trained and who has need, so that increasing the ability of having interpreters in community mental health centers would be one strategy that could be pursued.
That's what is happening in my community, in my county, in North Carolina, is that we have some interpreter/translator people who become experts in public health issues and translate for the public health department and for the schools. So they almost are shifting to this role of, you know, family liaison. liaison kind of thing.
Almost a community health worker at some
point.
Yeah,
it's interesting. But it's this the firm I'm thinking about is definitely a translation, you know, the background is language, non-black. But they've just come to emphasize public health all over.
I think a common theme that runs through, particularly the second two presentations, is, you know, how do we incentivize the workforce in the future? And also the kind of the, you're talking children's mental health versus other, is how do we get this whole community in relation, you know, the whole, not just in the healthcare setting, but also the social work aspect of it, the community support for, particularly as you said, disadvantaged populations. But also, I think all of the presentations have kind of identified gaps in training and organization of mental health organizations to be able to take on some of these challenges, but also I sense this also this stress is a cause of job dissatisfaction, and also they aren't paid enough and have more opportunities to advance, although that's probably not why a lot of mental health workers go into that field, is to make a lot of money. So that kind of...
I remember sitting in a it was in a meeting of, it was a professional organization for all the providers of the public mental health entities in our state, and someone said, how can we get more people to come out to the rural areas? And someone said, schools, and everyone else went, the quality of public schools was such that people trained as psychiatrists and other mental health professionals didn't want to come back to those areas with their families. So it's such a big issue. It's not just your work satisfaction, even though, although clearly that's part of it, a big part of it in our state. There's been so much change.
That's why school health
is
telling me,
you know, to shift employers and make
children and adolescents in school is still a primary delivery point, not only for all kinds of school health messages, but also we need, you know, good school health workers sort of on the front line, even more so than the community health center in some places. I like the mix of LA County and Massachusetts. I'm trying to get a geographical pattern.
But I was thinking too, and I'm thinking, gee, I surveyed for one agency, and then I reminded myself that LA County is bigger in population than perhaps most of the states. So
we're
more
like
than half.
A state, right? We're like a state, like, you know, you could, you know, depending on how you want to cut it, ten million people, right?
Any studies I see, start seeing a population, an N of five and six digits. It starts to be pretty significant.
Yeah.
When you're talking about small studies or focus group or interviews with less than 200 people, it's like, well, you know, this is pretty special.
And then we have the 8 region, and the 8 region in LA County are also very different. We have some that could be kind of considered rural, you know, and, you know, you talk about
the
people not wanting to go out
different
there and work, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, recruit out in what's called the Antelope Valley. Then, you know, you have, of course, you know, inner city LA, and then there's kind of the suburban urban, and then we have such a, you know, a demographic, you know, variety. It's extremely challenging. Extremely challenging.
About the language match.
Oh, right. I think we have like 13 official languages that we have translators for. But then, you know, I was actually working on helping the county work on their cultural competency plan for the state this past year, and I think we counted, when we did a little survey on other languages, I think we had at least 45 other types of languages, you know, in addition to those 13. So, you know, it's a little nutty.
Well, thank you very much. much.
Thank you.